I want to talk to you really about two or three key areas, the high visibility enforcement of seatbelt and alcohol laws that I and many others, including many in this room, have been involved in. And try to walk through these slides rather quickly. Looking around the room, I see many people who have actually lived this life as well, and I want to make sure we don't bore anybody. Obviously, it's one of the winnable battles, increasing belt use and reducing alcohol impaired driving. And thank you, Linda, for the new community guide on interlocks, which has proven very helpful in legislatures. Major public health issue, don't have to tell you. 2010 estimate, 32,788 deaths. More than 4,000 additional lives could be saved with 100% belt use, which I'm dumb enough to think we can do. 8,000 preventable from alcohol-impaired driving, and I really want to focus on the technology in, that's being worked on in Boston right now. And it remains the leading cause of death to ages 2 to 33. Belt use is not a new issue. It was installed in cars required by NHTSA's predecessor in 1964. In 1968, the Safety Council, where I was an inmate for 21 years, conducted an extraordinarily expensive a PSA campaign with the Ad Council. By the way, the Ad Council's not free. $51 million at the time, obviously a lot more now. At the end of all of that effort, people could still sing the song, Buckle Up for Safety, Buckle Up, but there was no, repeat, no difference in belt use. And there were many other, all these other messages didn't work either. And I want to get back, Steve Hartgard and I had an interesting discussion about why they didn't work, but we'll get back to. In 1984, belt use stood at 14%, been unchanged for 16 years. And then what changed everything was July 11th, 1984, when DOT Secretary Elizabeth Dole issued her airbag and seatbelt rule, the Motor Vehicle Standard 208. Up until 1984, all of the groups supported by the insurance industry supported airbags. All the groups that were supported by the auto industry supported seatbelts. It was always belts versus bags, and we always got nothing at the end. And her rule, extraordinarily, we could go all day on that rule alone, guaranteed that we were going to get either or both, and because of Willie Brown, I think, if you remember, Andrew, the hearing of Willie Brown, I remember, when John Claybrook and I came out to testify, it's a long story. We'll get into our anecdotage, but Willie Brown may have been the most brilliant, he was a strange guy, but he was probably the most brilliant state legislature I've ever met. Wait a second, that goes, this is going to take quite a bit there. All the way back. We're going to get through this pretty quick, let me assure you. The main thing I want to do, though, is make sure people understand that by the mid-90s, there were, and out of 208, the auto industry, literally, as Andrew and others will know, her rule said that we were going to get airbags phased in 1987, or automatic belts, another sad story, unless two-thirds of the states passed strong belt laws. The auto industry put up $110 million to go get belt laws to avoid airbags. And for those of you who don't, you have to trust us, it's the most amazing thing I've seen. Belt laws came in. There were some 46 by the mid-90s, 10 were primary, 30 states were secondary, and the key issue there was racial profiling. Weak knees in the state legislature. But New Jersey was the second state to enact. Deputy Speaker Willie Brown, not of California but of New Jersey, represented Newark, wanted a belt law, but was concerned about law enforcement stopping young men in his district and made it secondary. We'd never had secondary laws before. And that really crippled enforcement. New Hampshire, still the sole exception. Live free and die is their, or die is, I guess, their slogan. And belt use was mired at mediocrity at 62%. That's the left-hand part of that chart. You can see in 91 we made it to 62%, which really means very little, because the first 62% to buckle are the ones least at risk. We basically buckled up almost everybody that wasn't crash involved, and we're buckling up very few that were crash involved. North Carolina is where I spent four wonderful years working on the clicker to ticket program. In the spring of 1992, the chairman of the I was then at the Insurance Institute. I was senior vice president for propaganda. We didn't call it that, but for airbags and other worthy things. And the chairman of Nationwide Insurance was chairman of the board, and he asked Tim Hoyt and I if we could find him a state where we could put everything proven to work into one state, document it, evaluate it, and inflict that information on the other 50. He didn't say inflict. I say inflict the information on the other states. But why North Carolina, and most of you will know this already, had a primary belt law, good, strong state data program. The Highway Safety Research Center at Chapel Hill at University of North Carolina. Interestingly, bipartisan political leadership. How long has it been since we've seen that? We were invited in by Governor Jim Martin at the time, and Jim Hunt, Governor Jim Hunt, who was a remarkable figure, provided extraordinary leadership. The law enforcement leadership of North Carolina is fascinating. We'll talk about it. How many folks have ever been on a ride-along, by the way? You're missing out. It really, in order to really work with law enforcement, you have to really experience and respect and learn what they do. Obviously, it is not done perfectly every time. That's why we have a constitution. But to see when it's done well is pretty extraordinary. North Carolina Highway Patrol happens to be one of those models. Interesting, again, it was based on Canada was about 10 years ahead of us. I used to be a regular attendee at the CCMTA, the Canadian Council of Motor Transport Administrators. They had adopted the Elmira program, which the Insurance Institute had done in 1983, and had a national occupant restraint program in Canada that was 10 years ahead of us. Their belt use rates were in the high 80s. They used paid ads, particularly in the provinces where they had provincial health insurance programs that paid for it, the SAAQ, Société de l'Automobile d'Assurance de Québec, I'm butchering the name, was the one remodeled after for North Carolina. In the summer, we did three pilot. I probably ought to go over this more quickly, but three pilot programs. This, again, my main intent here is to prove to you this was not just a catchy slogan. This was done in the true public health rigor, where we did three pilot programs, Haywood County in the Mountain West, High Point in the Piedmont, Elizabeth City, a black university town in the northeast of North Carolina. And we raised those three, mind you, national belt use is 61%. We raised those, all three pilots, from a statewide use of 67% to 80%, one of only three states in the country at the time at 80%. We went in and met with Governor Jim Hunt. I'll never forget this. NHTSA, the regional administrator, was Tom Enright, very important there, the chairman of Nationwide, came. We met with and Jim Long, the insurance commissioner, a very colorful guy, and we presented the results of the pilot to get Governor Hunt's permission to go statewide. And he leaned across his dad, and we didn't have to explain it to him. He had been hit by a drunk driver in his late teens. He was alive to be governor because his father had retrofitted seatbelts in the car. We didn't have to explain anything. He leaned across, after we presented the data and asked for his permission to go statewide, he leaned across his desk. He didn't really pound on it. He just, for emphasis, he looked at the colonel of the state police, Bob Barefoot, and he said, Bob, he says, I want you to go back and tell your people I'm behind this program, and if they get any comeback, you tell them I can take it. Never been done in the United States before. The political permission to enforce is so key, and he gave full permission. The intensity of the enforcement is hard to actually explain. After the North Carolina Highway Patrol organized the state, they have a first sergeant in every county. We met with Command Major Jethro Wallace at the end of the first week. He showed us the sheet, Tim Hoyt and I. 97 out of 100 counties had done checkpoints. Now, and our jaws dropped. Many of them had done multiple checkpoints. And because this had never happened in the United States. And he looked at us and says, oh, don't worry, boys. He says, the other three are going to do better next week. And literally, the checkpoints were at a level of 10 checkpoints per county per week for 3 weeks, 3,000 checkpoints. It was virtually shake the earth enforcement. And because it was done superbly well, there was no backlash. One of the key lessons is there is no backlash to good law enforcement. These are, again, some of the lessons we can talk about. Insurance Commissioner Jim Long was the day-to-day political permission. He was a caricature of a Southern politician, really smart, but hit it well. And obviously people understood the reason that he would be doing a program like this is to keep North Carolina, I think he was always proud to say, has the fourth lowest insurance rates in the country, and the other four you have to call ahead to arrange a crash, with Dakotas and and other places. And then we launched the alcohol impaired driving, Booze It and Lose It, in 1995, and literally paired up with the National Roadside Survey that NHTSA was undertaking, heavied it up in North Carolina. We cut the drunk driving rate by more than 50%, 0.087 intoxicated drivers at nighttime checkpoints, which was a number never seen outside of Europe. And the Governor's Highway Safety Program, it continues really to do that program. This is what interrupted things. In 1996, I'd been at the Insurance Institute for 7 years. We began to get reports sporadically of airbag injuries. And being a highly successful organization, the first thing we did was deny them. Can't happen. We're on the side of God and motherhood. And then we heard about a crash in Ohio, an 8-year-old girl in a Volvo who was killed by an airbag car. We kept investigating this. But the pattern really didn't become unmistakable until 1995, 1996. The Special Crash Investigation Program at NHTSA is an extraordinary unit that actually documented really over the next several years, 141 confirmed deaths of kids by airbags, with 6 unconfirmed, for a total of 147 fatalities. Now, and it turned out these were not non-survivable crashes. These were not kids killed for some other reason. The force of the airbag deploying was the force that killed the child. These were in low-speed crashes where you wouldn't expect even injuries. Now, I don't want to get too gruesome, but the one that really riveted the country's attention was in 1996 in Boise, Idaho, where a girl driven by her, a little girl driven by her grandmother, was decapitated by the airbag. And if any of you can remember that time, we were all of a sudden woke up to the fact that we had an unmistakable pattern. We had 26 fatalities with 23 million passenger bag equipped vehicles on the road, and we were adding 1 million passenger bag equipped vehicles every month. That number was going to go to 10 times that number, and we obviously, no one has the right to put kids at risk. And yes, virtually all of them were either unrestrained or improperly restrained or in a rear-facing car seat in front of the passenger bag. But you know what? The penalty for being an improperly restrained child simply shouldn't be fatal injuries from a federally mandated safety device. And NTSB really was the first to wake up. They issued a recommendation. It was probably stronger than that, but it was in the form of a recommendation that car companies send a letter to every passenger bag-equipped vehicle owner in the United States, 23 million letters, informing them of the risk. Seemed to make sense. Except when you started to think about it, it's about $1 a letter. It wouldn't really affect new owners. Letters have no effect, even then being thrown in the trash. And so actually the auto industry, in one of its smarter moves, as different from other moves, decided this made no sense. Why didn't they partner with the insurance industry, take the Insurance Institute's model of click it or ticket, and do it on a national level and split the cost? And all the leading car manufacturers signed up. Some of the leading insurers signed up. Regrettably, only State Farm and Nationwide. Most of the other insurers walked away, even though they'd been the reason airbags were adopted. They walked away because they could. No liability, no federal regulatory pressure, even though airbags were killing kids. That wasn't a pleasant experience either, because I had more respect for many in the insurance industry than that. But anyway, we formed the Airbag and Seatbelt Safety Campaign as a result. And this is in July of 96, the NHTSA administrator and Jim Hall, NTSB chair, were the honorary chairs of the campaign. House of the Safety Council advocates and others were involved as well. We raised $47.5 million over 10 years. And as we had promised to do, we went out of business in 10 years. First mobilization. We started, just created it out of thin air, 1,000 law enforcement agencies with national belt use at then 62%, only three states above 80%, no states above 90%. As you can see to the right now, that march of progress continued through and even to this day where it's now 85%, that chart is dated. We did eight states in the southeast, an average of 9 points up, 10 states around the country, 8.6 points up. First national mobilization with paid ads, so key, was 2003. By the way, one of the things we did at the campaign is we put out for bid the communications contract. And all of the major firms, I think Edelman and Burson Marsteller and all the ones that you know and love, as do I, bid. And we rejected their bids because the first thing we wanted was a communications firm that knew what didn't work. Because all of the normal hype of market segmentation, mumbo jumbo, the ad council stuff, doesn't work. We knew that. And so we partnered with GMB, which does half politics, half public health, and was involved in Safe Kids and a variety of other things. And we, but whatever you do in communications, put it out for bid and make sure you choose a company that knows what doesn't work. Through 2010, 22 states additionally enacted primary laws, now 32 states. National belt use is now 85%. There are now 39 states above 80%, 15 states above 90, 5 states above 95. Michigan and Hawaii tied at 97.6%. Now, that would be more satisfying, except these are daytime use rates. This isn't when high-risk folks have their crashes. And if you look at the unbelted teen fatality rate, Sue Gallagher, I'm going to give you a number I can't get out of my head. In the year 2000, 15 years after Massachusetts had a strong job restraint law, 10 years after a weak secondary law, belt seatbelt law, do you know how, I'm going to ask, put Sue on the spot, do you know how many teen fatalities and motor vehicle crashes were unbelted in Massachusetts? Every single one. That we're kidding ourselves if we think these numbers, really are what we need. We need to really be looking at states and evaluating their unbelted teen fatality rates. You can get it right out of FARS. Their unbelted teen fatality rates, and see where we can take that number through nighttime enforcement, various other things. But again, this is, again, I bet everyone in the room would agree, no more trinkets, no more PBS or ad council programs. And not only not free, they don't work, they often displace what does work. And if I sound intense on that, I guess I am. if a program doesn't have enforcement, it doesn't have me. Because it doesn't work. This is what success looked like after 10 years with airbag fatalities finally going to zero in 2002. There's been one confirmed child fatality in 2003, I think, and none since. Our message, obviously, was that all kids 12 and under have to be in the back, where they're 30% better protected, further from point of impact and ejection. So this is where I'll hopefully get more interesting. Essential to stick to only what's proven by peer-reviewed research. The political permission we talked about. I'm going to lay all these out, and hopefully we'll get a conversation going. Political permission is absolutely essential if you can find another governor like Jim Hunt, it is a wonderful thing. The law enforcement leadership was and is key to success. Now the National Belt Program really isn't driven so much by NHTSA or any of the rest of us. It's driven out of competitive spirit by the commissioners of the highway patrols and the superintendents and chiefs of the state patrols around the country. The fact that Washington State is at 97.6% drives California crazy. They are only at 95.7%, I think. And the fact that Washington State is beating, there's just a wonderful level of competition for excellence, which is where the benefits are. So that issue of law enforcement leadership is key. Strategic communications plan is essential. Again, fire any ad firm that doesn't understand what doesn't work. Obviously, partnerships must be real and transparent. This is something I talked to Steve Hardgarten about on the way in, that the message of click it or ticket, there's no data behind this, by the way, is both less threatening and more credible, and that's one of the reasons it worked, in my biased opinion. All of the other messaging that the Safety Council and NHTSA and all the Governor's Highway Safety Association folks have done, buckle up because somebody loves you, buckle up because you might die, you know, that requires an admission. Buckling up is an admission you could be in a crash, something that high-risk folks don't want to do. Click it or ticket is less threatening. Doesn't require you to admit you're going to be in a crash. Just requires you to admit you're going to get a $25 ticket. That it takes away, it externalizes the risk, and I would love for Steve to comment on that. And another interesting point in North Carolina, the $25 went to local school boards, not the state. A lot of school boards figured out, hey, forget the bake sale. We want us a checkpoint. And the checkpoints were broadly supported and the public supported. The toward zero deaths in Washington State and also in Minnesota, and I don't know if any of you are, there are a couple of serious programs, many non-serious programs around the country. But that is one that I think for the goals, the winnable battles, Linda, that you are involved in, for serious states like Washington and Minnesota, there probably are others. That may be one of our best ways of getting there. Again, I mentioned that belly chute use rates are not when crashes occur. Here's a concept, too. I think you found social norming, I think, to be insufficient evidence, I believe, which I think is mild. I think, actually, social unnorming is what creates change in the United States. Mad, obviously, in 1980, it was perfectly normal to drink and drive. In 1980, it's how you got home. Until somebody really called the question, Candy Leitner and Andrew and I, she's a more complicated figure than we would prefer. But how did I say that?
Wow. You're being tape recorded.
Child pastor safety. Anybody know what the first state to enact a child restraint law was?
Tennessee.
And you know who did it?
Yeah,
Bob Sanders. Literally, he was tired of treating broken babies. And he and his wife, Pat, who is really co-conspirator on all this, would not let the Tennessee legislature go home until they passed the nation's first car seat law. And we got all 50 car seat laws before we got the first adult law in New York. I happen to believe that state models are best, sustainable, fundable, transportable. Local models, I know, are great, but they often disappear well before they create the results that we all want. State models are, in my bias, are the best. Are we?
Yeah.
Okay. But let me skip. Let me go to this chart right now and do drunk driving quickly. This is a perfectly horrible PowerPoint that is important that I just point out a couple things. This is not MAD data, where, as you know, I was chief mother for 5 years, but a volunteer for now 30 years, I guess. Andrew, you were a volunteer in the earliest days.
I was even paid at one point.
Yes, okay. This is data submitted to NHTSA of the number of three. I do a lot of editorial boards, and an editorial board with the Chicago Post-Dispatch. They said they collected data on the number of 3- and 5-time offenders in Ohio. I said, I'd never heard this. So I got Brian McLaughlin, the career staff at NHTSA is superb.
to actually go out to the 22 states that had the data available and ask how many three-time convicted drunk drivers were still on the roads, five-time convicted drunk drivers, 15 or more convictions, 20-plus, and the most by one person. Arkansas won the lottery, one guy with 40 convictions. Now, he died of cirrhosis about 3 years ago. No surprise. But look at the pattern. California, which has great enforcement, I think Andrew would agree with the California Highway Patrol, they have more than 310,000 people on the road with three or more convictions. And the pattern really is Massachusetts, who is, you know, is 22,000 people with three or more, 3,000, five or more. Am I doing that? No, 48, 45 or more, 32, 10 or more, one guy with 21 convictions. So when we're ready to declare victory, you know, all the great progress in drunk driving, I'm pleased to talk about all the time. The main reason why drunk drivers continue to kill on our roads today, the main reason they continue to drive, is because they can. And we let them. And interlocks really are a technical vaccine to prevent that from happening. And I got to show the last slide. This. Literally within 10 years, and actually the car will know when the driver's illegal and not operate. There's a wonderful public, there's a cooperative research agreement. Initially, $10 million, five-year cooperative research agreement between the auto industry and the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood. That is now through the phase, announcement of phase two will be in 2 weeks. The evaluation of technology of tissue spectroscopy and distance spectroscopy will be able to identify drivers over the illegal limit of 0.08, and the car probably will start, if you need air conditioning in Texas or heat in Alaska, that it won't come out of park. Within 2 years, there will be a test vehicle with this technology. There are actually two technologies, one by Takata, one by Autoliv, both primary suppliers. We literally can see the elimination, actually, probably the right word, Linda, is eradication, of drunk driving, not only in our lifetime, it will take probably 25 years for all the non-compliant vehicles to be on, but we literally have a technical vaccine for drunk driving. That there'll be a big press conference on November 16th with Secretary Ray LaHood to talk about the five-year anniversary. We've been able to drive interlock use in part because of the CDC recommended community guide. We've taken interlock use from one state with all conviction interlocks, New Mexico, and three at high BAC in 5 years now to 15 states plus the pilot program in California. Now I think 32 states with high BAC, and interlocks have gone from 101,000 to 249,000 in 5 years. But those are current technology interlocks. The real prize is the advanced technology, which would eradicate drunk driving. I'm done.
Thanks.